Angus Young, how you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl, how you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Hey, it's Becca. Welcome back to The Rider. Last week, Adelita from The Magic Dirt, and they are continuing their Aussie tour. And of course, you'll see Adelita regularly on the Rolling Stones review circuit as they travel around the different festivals this coming summer. If you missed Adelita for The Magic Dirt, you can get that right now. Catch up on all platforms.
This is The Rider.
This week on The Rider, one guest who I've always wanted to talk to, Tex Perkins, the man behind The Cruel Sea, The Beast of Bourbon. He's the man of a million stories, and he's just got that charisma. You put him and Tim Rogers in the same category, just two legendary Aussie artists. You're going to find out how this happened. The song behind the New South Wales Police Force. And recently we celebrated 30 years of The Honeymoon Is Over. So you might have grown up with The Cruel Sea, but then again, you might have grown up with The Beast of Bourbon. Can you believe it's been 40 years of The Beasts? I've just done a couple of shows recently, and one of my favourite bands of the late 80s. So Tex has done all that, but also still to come is the Man in Black tour.
I'm Tex Perkins. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, down, down. The flames went higher.
And in this edition of The Rider with Becca, going to find out from Tex Perkins how he started doing Johnny Cash. All that to come in the next 45 minutes. Let's get to him right now. There he is, Tex Perkins.
Oi.
How are you, mate?
There it is.
Can you believe it's been 40 years? The Beast of Bourbon, 40 years?
Yeah, I can believe it. But I'm starting to be able to measure time now and what decades mean. I see it as a long time, and I also see it as an incredibly short time too. So, some things just haven't changed. There's a part of me that still is that 18-year-old kid that joined that great band, and I feel the various onion-like layers of myself, and they still exist. There's versions of me that I interact with all the time. So yes, I still feel connected to that 40 years ago period. Yeah.
Well, I started off in Brizzy, but I guess I always see you as someone such an integral part of the Sydney scene. And what was the Sydney scene like in the all through the 80s into the 90s? I mean, it was very different to how it is now.
I think it was a bit of a golden age when I arrived in 82. There was a lot of great bands coming out of, or actually converging on Sydney, actually. Like my immediate friends were in bands like the Hooter Gurus and the Scientists and the Johnnies, and even the Cockroaches were sort of, going around at that time. And just all these bands that sort of just, There was a very communal kind of, there was a very community, a feel of community about it. And there was, I guess there were different camps, and we sort of, there'd always be, those guys. Yeah. whoever, what scene you can't, we're kind of competing against it a little bit. But within my mob there, there was, a good seven or eight bands that had a real camaraderie, and we'd all drink at the same places. Like the Sydney, the Trade Union Club on Favreau Street was incredibly important for the community of, the rock and roll community of Sydney in the early 80s. And, bands like Mental as Anything, they were like a band that has sort of taken the next step and sort of come a bit successful. And I always saw the Mentals as you can be actually a cool band and be popular. That idea was, I think, implanted in my head by the mentals.
Well, that's the thing. It's one of those most damaging things is when people accuse bands of selling out just because they've been successful. The thing is, you want your favourite bands to be successful. You don't want them to be bumming around the RSL scene or whatever too much. You want bands to be getting a bit of radio airplay and selling records. And, I think the Mentals are a great example of a band who are just so good live, but they also got radio airplay, and it was great.
Well, there is a difference between, they're deliberately going, well, this isn't working, let's change into it. Let's change into a completely different version of ourselves, and that's going to be more accessible to change your mission statement as a band in order to achieve that. That's a problem. But just to progressively get better at who you are and communicating with your audience, that was the sort of success that all the bands that I knew, like, that they'd build their fan base, and it was based on playing good live gigs, and then at some point radio would get a hold of it, and then it'd become this next level thing. It was all very much based on the live scene, and Sydney was very go back to your original question, Sydney was very good, fertile ground for there was lots of gigs, lots of pubs, and lots of punters,
and lots of record stores too. Like, I forgot that Red Eye actually had a record company, and I know you were part of that at one stage with one of the bands, and it's good to have Red Eye still around now, which is good, but I didn't know that.
Well, yeah, it came out of the record store. John Foy, who had been working in record stores all through the 80s, like cool, and even the 70s, there was, I think the original sort of got an import store in Sydney was called White Light, Records. Mm. And that, I think that changed into Phantom Records. And then at that stage, if you had your shit together enough to run a record store, you kind of had your shit enough together to run a record label. Mm. I think that, like, people like Jules Normington, who was running a record store, and then that called Phantom, then he was running a little record label called Phantom. So and that's sort of the same thing that happened with Red Eye. And John Foy, who had worked at all those record stores, basically it was a separate entity, but it used the Red Eye connection as a sort of and they were kind of connected, but they weren't connected as the same. They were two separate businesses, but if you could run a record store, you can run a record label back in the early 80s in Sydney.
I still love how you can walk into Red Eye and you got a member of the Hard-Ons there serving you as you walk in. And your mate Tim Rogers is back, he's fronting the Hard-Ons now as well. Like, what a step.
I thought you were about to say he's working in a record store. Ray?
Yeah, Ray. Ray works there.
Right. Ray, the bass player.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Ray's always been one of the coolest cats around.
Yeah, Tim was telling me in a previous interview that Ray is one of the great storytellers, and sit down with him for an hour and he'll tell you the most amazing bloody rock stories.
That'd be awesome. I've never been actually able to do that. My meetings with Ray and Blackie over the last 40 years have always been kind of fleeting. Like, hey, how you going? What are you doing?
Can imagine. And often it's probably meeting at truck stops, when you're on tour or something. And
there's a lot of people. Exactly, that you have relationships like that with each other every 5 years, and then you catch up in 10-15 minutes, and then boom, see ya.
They had another anniversary recently, is that right? Like the Cruel Sea honeymoon is over. Was that 30 years ago, a re-release? You put the vinyl back out?
Yeah. Some young idealistic fellas at the Universal who weren't around, probably weren't even born when the honeymoon is over came out. I guess anniversaries is a kind of a thing. It seems to be a bit of a thing. An alarm must go off at record companies and go, it's the 10th anniversary, it's the 25th anniversary. So you can always it's always a marketing, you know, it's a possibility, a bit of an anniversary. So, but anyway, yeah, these young blokes over at Universal said, hey, how about we do a vinyl edition, because it's never been done, of The Honeymoon Is Over. Yeah, and for the 30th anniversary. I was keen on that for the very fact that it came out in that little period of time where vinyl was just, yeah, forget it.
Yeah.
It's over.
It was expensive
it's,
and all
and
that
it's
stuff.
All about that's the only format we're ever going to be interested in again. Chuck all that other shit out and forget. The music industry goes through these periods of complete lack of, you know, vision. like this is the way it is and it's never gonna change. And like, yeah, 5 years down the track, 10 years to like track, shit, we really got it wrong, didn't we? It's amazing that they are as a collective mind. It's like it's like, you know, they're stumbling around, you know, in the dark, really, as far as yeah. And they didn't even see streaming coming.
No, you know, no, they were threatened by that. Streaming was the one where they were like, we're going to do everything we can to stop it, and it's not going to work. We won't make a dollar off it, you know, and there you go.
Yeah, and then they just went begging, yes, we'll take 2% if that's all right, please. And the streaming company goes, all right, but behave yourselves. Final. Come back to rescue everybody.
It's come back to rescue the charts, because all the bands are dependent on vinyl to get a number one, you know, because we were part of these messages, you know, working at radio stations where they were like, really push the vinyl. We want to get number one, but we're not going to get number one off streaming figures.
Oh, is that a thing that's happening now?
Yeah, yeah. Because I remember, I won't say what the album was, but I remember it was a big Australian album, and this is about maybe 3 years ago, and it was charting in the top 10, I think, most of the week. And then the vinyl numbers came out, I think, on the Friday, and they had a number one record by the weekend.
Is the charts a combination of streaming and physical products?
It is, yeah.
Or is there different charts? Or are there different charts?
I think it is a combination of both, but I think they weight the physical numbers of vinyl, and maybe even CDs are probably still counted as a higher weighting. So if you sell, you know, 1,000 records, you'll get a number one.
Yeah, but one physical product probably equals 100 streams, maybe.
Oh, God.
I'm not sure of the math.
Isn't it funny how it's all just changed? It's just nuts.
We'll be able to have it, you know, beam straight into our skulls in a few years.
That someone
we'll
said that.
Think of a song.
Yeah. That someone said that. I think it was Eddie Vedder. I remember hearing an interview where he says they're gonna be chips in your head.
It won't be like 1984, like you must have a chip. It'll be like you can have a chip, and most people go, oh fuck yeah, I'll have a chip. You mean I'll never lose my phone? Fuck yeah.
Well, I would have thought we'd put listening devices in all our houses. You know, now we're just like, oh yeah, yeah, no worries. Just put a microphone in each room in the house.
Hey, convenience always wins. You can talk about the environment and all this stuff, but you're up against convenience. and people are just so, yes, I'll, you're like, look, they're happy to live in these gilded cages, these apartments that are sort of so full of comforts, you know, like every comfort you can possibly imagine. All your entertainment just streams straight into you, like, and food delivered to the door, you know, like, and you know, don't, that's what they'll defend to the death. That actually, you know, whatever's going on outside the comfy bubble doesn't matter. They've got us by the balls.
I remember radio stations all saying internally, Amazon Alexa and Google and whatever, it's going to reinvent the way people receive radio. And I was like, oh, come on, that, you know, like, it's not going to work that way. But I'm guilty of it now, you know. I rather than having a physical radio, I'll literally yell at the speaker and say, play, you know, play Double J or play Triple J or Triple M or whatever. And it's just, you're right, it's convenience. I'm guilty of it.
Pretty soon it'll talk back to you saying, I don't think you're in the right mood to listen to that. Have you thought about I've been measuring your blood pressure, and I don't think it's a good idea that you listen to Talkback Radio right now.
Before we move away from the cruel sea, by the way, you got to tell me the story about the lost arias, because I know about a year ago you finally had a bit of a resolution on that. But that was one of the all-time great 90s stories of the cruel sea. And meanwhile, Triple J were loving it at the time because they were like, oh, my God, we're in the middle of this, and this is the one of the greatest rock and roll stories ever.
Well, yes. We begin at the 1994 arias, the cruel sea. As guess Kenny Lee G, the bass player, said in his acceptance speech for one of the five awards that we received at 96, we read in the paper that we were expected to clean up at these awards tonight. If you could all help by emptying the ashtrays and picking up your own bottles. We came away with a handful of arias. I personally had two in my hand when I went to the one of the after parties. Anyway, there was, to cut a long story short, there was a bit of a scuffle. Let's call it a bit of a scuffle. And myself and my girlfriend left suddenly, and leaving the two arias that I had been carrying around all night. And that's a significant thing to be carrying around, because they're quite heavy and they're quite pointy. And and you can't hold, drinks and, two arias. So anyway, to cut a long story short, we left suddenly. One of the arias was, collected by one of the other members of the band, and the other found its ways into the hands of what do you call people that demand ransoms?
Kidnapper,
Well, they've kidnapped the aria, they claimed. And yes, they did indeed. They contacted Triple J. And that's actually another level that I'll return to later in the story, because of information that I have received. But anyway, we have the aria. We won't give it back until our ransom demands are met. And there was a few sort of joke ones, like Michael Bolton's work visa must be terminated and things like that. On our list was James Cruikshank, our keyboard player, must be reinstated into the band. Now, he wasn't out of the band. He'd been in a car accident a few weeks beforehand, so that's why he wasn't at the awards. Yeah. So anyway, in due time, was indeed back into the band, so they got what they wanted out of us. Anyway, strangely enough, that all happened. Strangely enough, we just went on with our lives without following it through. You see what I mean?
Forgot all about it.
We forgot all about it. And we didn't go, okay, you got what you wanted. Let's give us the aria back. We literally forgot about it. I have stories over the years that, somebody sold it for a pound of marijuana. That's a lot of marijuana.
That's a lot of weed, yeah. Yeah.
That's like a pillowcase. But anyway, that was a sort of a urban myth that I heard along the way. But anyway, time passed, as you know. At the end of 2021, started getting messages from people saying, hey, there's a ARIA award on Facebook Marketplace up for sale. The starting price of $1. It says found in a bin. Includes newspaper clipping outlining the ransom situation. A crumpled 30-year-old bit of the Sun Herald. People are contacting me. I've never even fucking heard of Facebook Marketplace.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
It's like eBay, I guess, or something like that. And anyway, being told about it. But meanwhile, this guy is getting an avalanche of, how fucking dare you? out of the general online community. The classic Facebook lynch mob is being, formed, and they're going to take this guy down. And they're like, who is this guy? You know, like, and literally, we looked it up. There was a feed, and they were putting his, putting a picture of his house up there.
Oh God!
You know, and giving the, giving his address. You know, like, and you know, this fucking, you know, this totally threatening. You know, like, I'm gonna go around there, all this. You know, there was various feeds, but the one that was getting really aggressive that we had control of, we just shut that shit down. And anyway, he shut his shit down as well. Like, fucking hell. I didn't realize I was gonna fucking do this. Kenny Lee G, again, our bass player, somehow got to him directly, you know, on the phone. And this guy's freaked out, like, fuck, I don't know anything about it. And anyway, Kenny said, look, just calm down, meet me and we'll have a talk about it. And he's a lovely fellow. And he took this bloke out off the ledge, so to speak. And they were planning to meet up in a few days, but they both got COVID. So the meeting got delayed by a couple of weeks. But when they eventually did, yes, Ernie, his name was, gave up the aria for a slab of beer. A slab of VB.
And he finally got it back.
And then a few weeks after that, Kenny gave it to me. And I'm like, shit, where is it? It's somewhere around here.
It's on the bookcase, you know, holding up a couple of books or something. You know,
it's hammered into a wall somewhere.
Yeah. What was the bit of info you're going to talk about with the Triple J-related information?
Yeah, I talked to Angela Catern, who works at the ABC and was a Triple J presenter back in the day. Still works at the ABC. Anyway, I had a chat to her recently and she said, it was a girl that worked at Triple J who was the ransom. Wow. Yeah. So it was an inside job at Triple J. You know, the bit that it said found in a bin? You know what bin that was? It was the bin that was the industrial bin behind Sony Music.
Oh.
So there's been a bit of a journey. Like, so yeah, originally it was somebody from Triple J that took the aria and then did the whole ransom demand thing, bought it off that person for a pillowcase worth of marijuana. And then who knows how many years it, you know, and the journey it's made to get into the offices of Sony Music and then end up in the bin.
This is a perfect story.
I know. It's like we could make a mini series out of that. You know, just like, and we could just fill all the, you know, like they do with historical events. They've got sort of certain facts that they've got to sort of stick to, but we can fill in the blanks of at least 25 years of that ARIA Awards, you know, journey. It's like we could take it. It goes to Antarctica by accident. You know. Up in the Congo in a diamond mine, yeah.
Now, I caught up with you briefly at the Monday Bash last year. It was you and Tim and Adelita on the Rolling Stones review lineup, and I really enjoyed watching you guys, backstage, how you prepared. And I thought you were the most relaxed out of the three, you know. Like, Adelita has her warm-up, you know. Tim has his warm-up of smashing a beer, and you were just literally there side of stage with a cup of tea, or it might have been a throaty sort of concoction.
Well, yeah, I was crook. I guess it must have been some kind of flu, but it was I had some throat problems, and I fall back on me throaty tea. I was probably inwardly shitting myself because it was very cold as well. You know, like a lot of times, even when your throat is fine, you can walk out onto a freezing cold open air stage and like, fuck it. You know, you're singing like you're a fridge.
The stage manager, I think, was off running after you because you'd sort of gone for a wander, and I think Tim or Adelita was just coming off and they're like, where's Tex? Where's Tex? And the band are just kind of like,
they're all, yeah. They're always doing that. I like to go for a little wander, me time, but I'm not too far.
I rocked up there about 11 a.m. and it's the most rock and roll thing ever is, pulling up at the back and there's Tim already having a beer at like 11 o'clock in the morning, smashing a VB, and I just thought, oh, that's such a fucking rock and roll thing. I can't believe you and Tim are kind of like now considered the elder statesmen of Aussie rock and roll, you know? Like, who would have thought?
There are more elderly statesmen than us. But yeah, we've entered the club. We're allowed into the elder statesman club now. But yeah, we're going through our initiation process. We're not on the board. We're not allowed in.
No.
We're not allowed into the board meetings where real shit gets decided by the elder statesman.
You're two blokes who you want to photograph though, because you know I said to Tim a couple of times is he's got that. Those features, oh, yeah. You know, that you want to paint him.
The cut of his jib. Well, if I actually do understand the meaning of that term. Yes, I like the cut of his jib.
Now, you're about to move into doing the Man in Black. I've been hearing the ads on the radio and everything, and that's something you come back to regularly, and you do it really well. I was going to ask you how... Did you get on to doing, you know, those shows and doing Johnny Cash?
Yeah, it's been a long journey. I grew up with a fairly musical family, and there was lots of, you know, there was music in the house, but it was the first thing that I was really paying attention to was radio, and especially breakfast radio, ABC breakfast radio, you know, when I was a little fella, like a five-year-old, six-year-old. And, you know, songs like Puff the Magic Dragon would, like, you know, like, whoa, what the hell's going on? And another song around that time where I was sort of very impressionable and sort of listening, like, it was the first time, you know, first time I was receiving, you know, like you hear things, but they don't really penetrate, and you don't really start to think about it until about five or six, and you analyze your feelings about it. And I remember hearing a boy named Sue. And the whole weirdness of the story, and yeah, that you know the, but it was the first time I'd heard about a world of mud, blood, and beer, where people were, you know, horrible, and you know, and it was filthy, and it was a gentle look into the darker side of life, if you will, and I guess I've been. Kind of had a bit of a taste for that ever since. And, you know, the next step, a bit older than that, you know, I'm hearing, you know, music like Sticky Fingers, you know, the Rolling Stones from my brother's record collection, and going, whoa, what is going on there? You know, more intrigued, rather dark, you know, side of all that. You know, there's all that. Also, I'm enjoying the Beatles too, and La-Di-Da, Sunshine, all that. But Johnny Cash, was the first to open the possibilities of the dark side. Mm. if I can sound a little bit like Darth Vader for a second, it's been a long thread, you know, right from then for my musical appreciation. And in 2009, I got approached to be in a theatrical production. They were very, you know, specific that it was going to be on in a theatre, that situation is not rather than a rock gig, and that sort of environment gives a certain reverence, you know, and it, people go to there to see a show, you know, like, well, when you're playing a club or a pub, you know, some people that just get there to get pissed, and it was quite successful. The show evolved over time. I got a bit of a reputation for doing Johnny Cash, and then I would be invited to do other things in a Johnny Cash kind of context. Sydney City Council came to us and said, would you go and play Parramatta Jail? You know, we want to put an event on there, and we want you to play like the Johnny Cash Folsom Prison concert, in the freshly closed Parramatta Jail.
Wow.
That had only been closed for 2 years. And you go to that place and it's like, oh, my God, you had human beings in here? But anyway, then we did a series of shows literally in all these historic jails around Australia. So that was a really interesting chapter. The latest Man in Black that we're going to present, Tex Perkins' Man in Black, we're freshening up the script, and there's aspects that I kind of want to explore a bit more. The original show only sort of touched upon. I'm quite fascinated with the Rick Rubin years of Johnny Cash's career, the last 10 years of his career, which was his great comeback. He had many comebacks, but the Rubin years are just incredible.
Well, that's the thing. Doing Hurt is still one of the most incredible, as you say, a comeback for anyone. And I'm still amazed how well that came off.
All kudos to the Rick Rubin, who is, I think, a genius of some kind. And with him, it's not particularly about knob fiddling. Just understanding who that artist is. Just slowly bringing out the best in them, and it's an ongoing sort of conversation and relationship. It's far deeper than just sort of, that song sounds good, it's the way he works with people. He does this with all sorts of people, but he's been making records for since the 80s, like hip hop and heavy metal kind of records. But I think when he worked with Johnny Cash, it was the first time that he sort of had this idea of, really sort of trying to understand who an artist is. It's a self-examination. It goes real deep, and there's a real belief in the healing. I think Johnny Cash always believed this, but Rick Rubin especially believes that there's a healing power to music, and especially a healing power in the creative process.
It's a fascinating story.
Doing Johnny Cash, I have a sort of a natural sort of the timbre of my voice, and where my voice is comfortable is comfortable in Johnny Cash's range, and I can, as I say, comfortable there, and I can play around in that area all day. Why do I find such an affinity to it, and why do I connect with it? That's an examination that I'm doing on myself. The answers could be troubling.
do you properly get into character? Do you think of yourself as channeling? No,
No, not really. But I do. I do in songs. I mean, I don't look. I'm not pretending to be Johnny Cash when I sing one of his songs. But I inhabit the song. I always inhabit the song. Whatever I'm doing, that's how you make it good. It's not like acting, but it's similar way.
It sort of is.
You're not just sort of painting by numbers. You've got to find the bit that's you.
I really loved your shows at home during COVID, because it was edited up like a proper show. It was like you were doing a variety show on the ABC or something. It wasn't what everyone else was doing, where they were doing, live to Zoom or live to Facebook. It was a bit more than that.
Well, exactly. It was, people were doing this and going ding, diddling, ding in front of their phones.
Yeah.
And that was good and necessary for a while, but it quickly got old, I live on a property and we've got this thing we call the hall, the great hall, and it's where my missus likes to hold social gatherings rather than have it in the house. We've got a little bar down there and a pool table, some couches and a fireplace, and we put a stage down on one end, and we've got a mate that's got a PA and he's got a light system that we've got a bit of a collaboration with him going. So we had all the infrastructure to kind of do something that was a bit, not high production, but better than, playing in front of your phone. So, and it also just gave us all something to do, because it was so, sort of bang, everything stops, and as creative people, first of all, we kind of felt an obligation to connect, because there was so much sort of, at the early stage, it was like we were expecting people to sort of feel very isolated, and as people in the communication arts, we felt a kind of responsibility to, to keep people entertained and connected, but also we thought, this is the new reality. This is the only way you do a gig. Let's see if we can make a living, but found out that you can't.
No.
On the first one that was free, we had like 10,000 people watching it live. Mm-hmm. And then the next one, we asked for like, you know, $5 or something, you know, and there was like 400 people.
Yeah.
People are just too used to getting shit for free, you know, over the internet. And really the only economy for working musicians is to go out and play.
Yeah.
You know, there's... Yeah. You can't pay the bills with vinyl sales.
No,
you
know, no, no.
Like
I got to one of those club shows you did just sort of midway through the pandemic, I guess it was. Or was it like Camerate, North's Leagues, and you were doing multiple shows a day? You might have done two or three shows. And I went to one of them and it was it was really good, but it was just like it was a shame, you know, that the restrictions were so tight where you could only have maybe 60 people in a room, you know.
The 2020 was quite still workable. Like, yeah, there were COVID shows, which meant, yes, like I could work pretty much anywhere within New South Wales. So, like, anywhere where I could drive to, you know, with a mate, you know, another musician, we could do a show. And those shows, yeah, would usually be an early show, back down, and then get a new crowd in. And, well, you couldn't really call it a crowd, could you?
It was all tables and chairs. It was like a dinner and show almost, you know.
But I kind of enjoyed that. Mm. This is how it is. And, that, you know, because as a musician, you've always got to adapt. You've always got to be ready for the game to change. and you've got, yeah. And I quite enjoyed that. It was 2021 that really, yeah, That was the year that I didn't cope very well with 2021, and kind of fell into a bit of a heap with my mental state. And
because we all thought it was over, and then it just came back worse. Yeah.
Society was kind of tearing itself apart, and everybody arguing and pointing fingers and fucking, and it was just an ugly kind of vibe. And I just really retreated into whiskey. Irish whiskey. I think it helped.
Mm.
I needed to numb myself. When it was over, I said to myself, okay, that's enough. Thank you, Jamisons. For a while, I really thought, fuck, this is getting worse. There's no way out. And then I stopped watching the news, paying attention to anything, and just went into my depression bubble. And it just assumed, yeah, the worst.
We all drank a lot.
Then we got to the end of 2021, and it was like, no, this is going to end. Shit's going to open up again, and you got work. And it was like, fuck, what? Really? Oh, shit. So I literally, bang, you know, I stopped my sookiness and then fucking just prepared to face the world again. And I was happy to do so, really. I mean, the January of 2022, the productivity that I was involved with, once I got back with my musicians, the Fat Rubber Band, I'm talking about the band that I work with these days with Matt Walker, we were separated for, you know, all that time. And so, like, when we finally got back together physically in January 22, it was like, bang, 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 record, record, create, create. And it was just like, oh. And it was fucking magic. It really was fucking magic. I will never forget the contrasts, the contrast of how I was like 3 months before that, and then being back amongst my people and doing what I'm supposed to do. And it was coming together so beautifully and effortlessly, and I cannot help but call it magic.
Well, we all sort of expected a big wave of music out of COVID, and we definitely got that. I was expecting more protest music because of all the shit that was going down. You know, not really here so much, but over in the States. And I was thinking of, you know, Margaret Thatcher era, you know, British rock, you know, that I thought that might happen, but it didn't end up really happening in the end. I think everyone was sort of more concerned with putting happy music out because everyone was literally so happy just to be at the other side.
Protest music, well, exactly where you're going to point your protest. There was a period of time when you couldn't question. There was no questions to be asked. You're either on board or you're a fucking freak or you're a fucking conspiracy. Don't fucking ask questions. And, you know, like, yeah. What do you mean? You know, what, don't you trust science? Yeah, but can't we just, no. So, like, yeah, there was all that shit going on. Like, can't we ask fucking some questions about this fucking thing? Well, you've had your time for questions. You're like, now let's get on with it. where was protest music gonna fall into that? You had to be so fucking careful.
And there were, that's the thing. It was a polarizing thing. And that's true. There were many careers wiped away, I think, because of that whole era too, because of the political stance and whatever. Well, and
we better be careful.
It was such a contrast because I was thinking about, you know, okay, doing that show I saw you at, as opposed to, you know, moments like supporting the Rolling Stones at the MCG and things like that. I mean, you were hanging backstage and watching the band, you know, just waiting around, because I guess that's the life of the musician, is literally the waiting. You're sitting around waiting to go on stage and waiting to jump on a plane and waiting for the bar or whatever. And you got to sort of be an observer and watch the Stones wait to go on stage and kill time.
I don't mind the waiting, personally. Actually, I mean, there's never true waiting. I mean, like, maybe for the Rolling Stones, where they've got 100 people taking care of every little detail of their fucking lives. Yeah. It was pretty funny. Yeah, because they had a backstage area. It was the Voodoo Lounge tour, and the green room was called the Voodoo Lounge. And it had, you know, a buffet, and it had big TVs and couches, and it had a full-size billiard table where Ronnie and Keith would push around balls, whatever the fuck they were playing. Funniest one was they had a – you remember the Daytona machines they have in pubs?
Yeah.
They had one of those, and I was standing next to it one day with our drummer, Jim Elliott, and Mick Jagger comes in and says, "Oh, g'day, lads, how you doing?" And then he just glances at, you know, the Daytona machine and says, "Hey, I fancy a game." And I said, "Fuck yeah, let's go." And I was quite adept at the Daytona machine. after many hours at the Bondi Hotel with Jim Elliott, but Mick had his L plates on. It was kind of embarrassing to absolutely wipe the floor with Mick. It was I actually had to stop and wait for him. It was so bad. So you don't want to outshine the boss.
No. And especially the boss of the Rolling Stones.
I had no intention of embarrassing him, but I probably stifled my career right then. He could have opened a lot of doors for me, Mr. Jagger, but I chose to beat him at Daytona, and I screwed that whole thing up.
Were they always expecting you guys to be punctual? Because I know some bands who are supporting, say, AC/DC, they got their, you know, the plug pulled because they were running late, and with AC/DC, you had to be, you know, right on time, no matter what.
We were happy to get off that stage. we probably played short, you know, to make sure we didn't get pulled. But it wasn't an overwhelming experience because, we weren't using their light show. We were given the bare minimum. I won't say we were given the classic support band treatment, using the full might of the Rolling Stones, you know, sound system and their lighting show. It was kind of like being ignored by 100,000 people, really. You know, it's a bit like playing at the football. Or there's special event days, you know, like grand final. That's one thing. But then there's Anzac Day, and I've played on Anzac Day. You know, they'd have a band open on a Friday night. Little experiment they had with putting bands on before the football, and it just didn't work. It was literally you were being ignored by thousands and thousands of people.
Well, before we go, I want to finally ask you about getting the phone call that the New South Wales police were going to start using Better Get a Lawyer, Son in their campaign. What was that phone call like? Did you ever think that would happen?
I never saw it as the police. When you think about it, I guess it is the cops. I never actually connected the dots, you know, like...
Just some, you know, 21-year-old hipster at an advertising agency thinking, yeah.
It's weird. That actually paid off for years. We'd get rollover money. Like, they kept going there for about 5 years.
It was a long campaign.
And they didn't really, you could only even barely just hear it.
What a payday.
But, yeah. Quite ironic, as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tex, it's so good to spend some time with you. Thanks for, you know, the generous stories you've given me, and you've got a few things coming up. You got the Beast of Bourbon, the 40th anniversary, a couple of shows in Sydney and Melbourne. The Man in Black, so you'll be doing Johnny Cash around the country as well. So, mate, that's good to keep you busy, and I can't wait to see you on stage soon.
It's been good to talk to you. It's been a pleasure, mate. T Cheers.
Just a couple of incredible stories there from Tex Perkins. What an absolute legend. Make sure you check him out on tour doing The Man in Black. All those details on Tex Perkins on Facebook. And by the way, if you want to go back and check out Tim Rogers on season one of The Rider, many crossovers there with Tex Perkins as well. You can catch up now on all platforms. We'll catch you back soon. This is The Rider with Becco.